Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a festival over two weekends challenges attendees to do something with their inspiration.
And we'll meet a comedian who thinks we need more nuance in conversations about infidelity.
But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We feel good about the arguments that were made, and we feel good about the questions that came back from this bench. We are hoping for a positive result.
People are always saying that they wish they had better candidates that would run for office. I don't think that's true, because when good people run for office just because I want to serve my community, and then this is what happens to me, why would anyone want to run?
Regarding this project specifically, where the project is supposed to go, nobody wants it.
It was an overwhelming victory to the point where there is no real reason, no logical reason, why the 800,000 constituents of Congressional District 7 of Arizona are lacking that representation.
They've created an ideologically pure group on both sides who are voters who are not only grievance voters, but their single greatest grievance is this: they hate the other side.
And joining me to talk about the results from this week's elections, an endorsement in a contested congressional primary, and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Cobb. Regina, good morning.
Good morning.
And Jason Barraza of Veritas. Jason, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Regina, let me start with you. Obviously, big elections this week. Some of the bigger contests were outside of Arizona, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But we heard just a second ago from Julie Spilsbury speaking with 12 News, now former Mesa, or soon to be former Mesa City Council member. This was a really interesting race. It got a lot of national attention for a Mesa City Council recall election. Turning Point USA, of course, was behind put a lot of resources into this and was in many ways behind the recall. I'm curious what you make of the result and maybe what it means specifically for Turning Point going forward.
I think you're going to see this as we go into the election year. Turning Point has increased its membership and has increased its footprint in politics. It was mainly Arizona and some, you know, around the nation. There were others, but mainly in Arizona. But ever since Charlie Kirk's incident, it is just exploded. And I think that their influence is going to be a little bit bigger now in all across the nation, not just in Arizona.
So, Jason, if you are of the mind that you do not like what Turning Point stands for, how do you try to counteract that?
Well, you got to talk about what they're doing, and for the race here. I mean, look, they're stepping out and they're speaking against bipartisanship, right? You have an individual who is a Republican who stepped forward and said, "I'm going to endorse these candidates because that's what I believe in," and now you have Turning Point that stepped forward and said, "Nope, that's not going to cut it. We don't believe that that's what you should be a representative of the Republican Party if that's what you're going to stand for," and they held her accountable. That's politics. That should be a consideration that all electeds have when they're stepping forward. And you should certainly have an organization like Turning Point who is going to hold people accountable for the politics that they believe in.
Do you think, Regina, I mean, we've heard that Turning Point is looking to get into, you know, sort of down ballot races. This is obviously sort of a down ballot race, a city council race. They're talking about, you know, spending resources on the SRP board elections, which is really down ballot. You mentioned how Turning Point has increased its membership. Obviously, you know, they've brought in a lot more money and donations since Charlie Kirk's assassination. Do they have, I mean, this maybe is a silly question, but do they have the resources to do what they want to do on the national level and also focus on down ballot races in a place like Arizona?
I think they do. I think they have the resources, especially now. I think they have the resources. I would say prior to that, they didn't. I think they needed to focus on the national races and then maybe state races, but not down ballot races. I think they have the resources now. It's a scary thing to think that, you know, you just what Jason said, that it's a bipartisan person, somebody that is a Republican but has done some Democratic moves and moved to the left on some issues. And because of our votes, we're going to have somebody like Turning Point that's going to go against them. I don't disagree with some of the things that they stand for, but I do disagree with influencing the elections the way they have.
Well, Jason, you mentioned bipartisanship. Do you think that this result and maybe the fear that it could strike in elected officials and other offices, like, could this do something to make bipartisanship even less common than it is now at all levels of government?
Yeah, I don't even know if it exists right now in Arizona politics or national politics, because people have been held accountable for it for so long. Look, Turning Point in what they're doing, this conversation of do they have the resources, do they available, this is a conversation that political parties normally have, right? Do they have the resources? Do they have the time to spend their money in large races, small races? You know, decisions need to be made about where to have those resources, and that's usually the purview of our political parties. Turning Point is really stepping in with that ground game that we've kind of lost in a lot of our political parties. And they're coming forward and they are expending the resources. They are putting the bodies forward to have an impact. And that impact is what is going to need to be taken into consideration by certainly Republican members, or Republican elected officials.
And I think we're going to see this in the governor's race. You look at Andy Biggs and Karen Taylor-Robeson and Schweikert right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you're going to see them play a big piece in that.
Well, and Turning Point has endorsed Andy Biggs already.
They have. But they've already put money behind him too.
Mm-hmm. Regina, before we move on from this, I want to get your response to what we heard from Julie Spilsbury. As a former elected official yourself, I'm curious what you think about when you hear her say, basically, people say they want better candidates, but then look what happens when we try to do what we think is right.
I can't disagree with Julie. I think she is a good candidate and probably represented a lot of what I represented when I was a candidate. And I think that you're going to see less of that. You're going to see where people, when they get into office, they're going to try to figure out how they can get endorsed, how can they can get the money. When they do that, they usually lean to the right and to the left. They don't go to the middle. I think we need more of that in the middle, and I don't know how we get back there.
Jason, there's been so much attention on the other races around the country, the New York City mayor's race, the Virginia, New Jersey governor's races, a few others. And it's sort of universally accepted right now. The conventional wisdom is Tuesday is a really, really good day for Democrats, good night for Democrats. I'm wondering if you think there are any lessons that Arizona Democrats can learn from what we saw on Tuesday.
I think that some of the lessons that are out there are lessons that our successful Democrats here have already kind of learned. If we're looking at Virginia, we're looking at New Jersey, it was the moderate candidates that won on kind of that statewide race. They brought forward a pro economic agenda. They stayed in the middle of the lane. And I think Arizona Democrats have already been doing that. If you look at our statewides, that's the position that they've been taking. Certainly in the New York City mayor's race, you had a candidate that could be more progressive, could be more liberal. They did that and they survived. They won. That should have been what you would have expected to see in a very progressive, very liberal race.
Yeah, I guess, Regina, it's clearly not an apples-to-apples comparison here, because New Jersey and Virginia, and certainly New York City, far more Democratic than is Arizona. But I wonder if, you know, if Republicans in Arizona look at these results and say, maybe next year's not shaping up so well for us.
I think that we need to always be on your heels. You need to always be looking at yourself as, if you're running, I'm running in last place, and I got to make myself go into first place. I think you cannot take anything for granted. And the Republicans should look at that. It's not any different than the last time Trump was in office, mm-hmm. and then a midterm election happened. It's exactly the same. So you got to change your tactics and move towards what is successful.
And a year in politics is, as we all know, like an eternity. I mean, it's forever in politics. But, I mean, do you see, you know, momentum for Democrats from Tuesday that could potentially carry over to 2026?
They should. But I don't see the Democrat Party being so organized that they're going to be able to do that. I think that they have a difficult time as it is. But they should be able to have momentum going into this. I don't see it happening.
I like how you're channeling your inner Will Rogers there, where he famously said, I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat, right? Jason, do you see momentum? I guess what do Democrats have to do, maybe, is the question, to capitalize on the momentum they had and keep it going for another year?
Well, I hope that they're paying attention nationally at kind of the issues and the topics that were discussed here and that we're successful, right? Democrats need to start talking about the economy more. When that happened, they were able to be successful. And I hope that more pick up on that going into the midterm. It is set up. We're expecting to see a Republican downturn. That's what happens in the midterm election. The factor here that I think that is important to keep in eye is President Trump, right? He turns everything on its head. Will we see a decline in Republican support in the midterm? Who knows? Trump may be able to change that. Hopefully, from my perspective, no, he isn't. We see a downturn in support for the Republicans, and the Democrats have positioned themselves perfectly with a pro-economic agenda that they can take advantage of that.
I guess the one caveat to that, though, are voter registration numbers, right? Where Republicans have far outpaced Democrats over the last number of months and years, right?
Well, they certainly have. I think that where Democrats can get a little solace there and find a little bit of protection is just because the numbers are increasing, there's still a lot of Republicans out there that haven't accepted the Trump and MAGA agenda fully. They're willing to now go to have a split ballot, where we used to complain about Democrats would split their ballot all the time. I think we're starting to see more of that in kind of that moderate Republican that's out there.
Very briefly, before we go to break, I want to ask each of you if you are in any way surprised that the bond and override in the Tolleson district failed, given sort of all the questions that have been and controversy that have been swirling with that district.
Absolutely not. If that bond had passed, I would be so disappointed in the voters for that. I think there's too much controversy, and they haven't even turned over the finances. So you don't know what they're doing. And to build a huge stadium the way that they wanted to do with the bond, if the voters would have passed that, I would have been 100% surprised.
Jason, surprise for you?
No, not at all. The economy is still forefront at the voters' mind. I think that is an indicator here. So you put in that in light of you have a district that isn't fulfilling some obligations. Why would they support something like that?
All right. That is Jason Peraza. I'm also joined by Regina Cobb. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Jason Peraza of Veritas and former state lawmaker Regina Cobb. Regina, let me start with you in the CD5 GOP primary. This is the seat that Andy Biggs is vacating to run for governor. President Trump this week endorsed Mark Lamb, the former Pinal County sheriff. This is, of course, a contested primary. How significant is that for Sheriff Lamb? And I guess maybe the second half of that question, do you think that will be the only endorsement in that race that President Trump gives?
I do think it's going to be the only endorsement that he gives. But he gave a semi-endorsement for Feely, if you looked at that.
To run for something else or
something
do something else.
Yeah. They didn't even mention Grantham, which is I think him and Feely are about even right now as far as the polls go. So I don't know. I don't think he's going to endorse anybody else. I think he'll continue just having the one endorsement, just pushing Feely off to say, hey, you need to run for something else so that you don't take the votes away from Lamb.
And in a district like that, I would imagine, I mean, it's a very, very conservative Republican district. I would think the Trump endorsement probably, does that seal it for Mark Lamb?
It gives him a big push forward, and he already had a big push forward. He has name recognition where the other two didn't. And so I think that his name recognition from the Senate race was probably put him ahead right away.
How big of a push, Jason, do you think the Trump endorsement gives to Sheriff Lamb?
Well, I think it's huge, and it's completely necessary in a Republican primary. It's something that has to be had. I'm surprised that we've seen it given so freely to others in the past, where we're even having a conversation about whether or not another endorsement is going to be made. I would have assumed that the Trump organization would be smart enough to protect that endorsement to their fullest ability and be very sparring in where they give it out. But yeah, I'm surprised that Mr. Grantham hasn't had more of a conversation about him and being one of the few people who's actually kind of won in the district itself that's there. And we always forget about the kicker. Well, why are we always forgetting about, you know, paying attention to the kicker out there? You know, so we'll see what happens in that.
And Grantham has the experience too, yep. and
he's had a couple stints in the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and he's been you know, our rules chairman, speaker pro tem. He's had some major roles in the legislature, and yet he wasn't even mentioned.
So, Regina, what do you think Jay Feely does? He was basically told, I like you, but don't run in this race.
I think he's going to probably watch it for the next few months and then see where his numbers go. If the numbers stay under 10, where they're at right now, I would suspect that he would get out of that race. It's hard fundraising if you don't have a lot of numbers behind mm-hmm. you, and he's going to have a difficult time raising funds.
If he gets out, do you think he runs for something else?
I would suspect he would. And he seems to be a political guy. I would suspect that he's probably going to run for something else. Hopefully, you know, he's getting into a lane that he can actually win in.
Jason, you're nodding your head. Do you think, assuming that Feely gets out of this race, does he run for something else? And maybe does he even run for something else this cycle?
Yeah, I would hope that he keeps his name in. I hate it when people put their name in, get civic orientated, and then they pull it back. So, you know, I hope he stays in this whole endeavor in whatever he is doing. But whether or not it's this cycle or not, I haven't actually looked at the area, so I don't know what races are going to be popping up and available. But if he does, in fact, drop out of this race, take the time, look at what's out there, and then start putting in the work today to make that a soft landing, and then you are the de facto candidate for that race in the future.
I mean, there is an open congressional seat just a little bit away, right? Like the CD1, this race that David Schweikert is also vacating to run for governor. Do either of you see a possibility of Feely running for that this year or next year?
I would say not. I think that's a long – if he's not going to be able to make it in this congressional district, why would he move over to congressional district 1? And you have Gina Swoboda and you have Dr. Shaw, both Representative Shaw, both running in that district that are strong people. I think it's going to be difficult for him to find his way into another congressional district. I think he needs to either do a state office or run in his city councils.
Mm. Jason, do you agree with that?
A down ballot race would be good. Congressionals are hard, especially when they're going to be crowded. And in CD1, you're probably going to have a very competitive general election. Don't know if it's the right fit for a first-time candidate.
Okay. So, guys, we are in uncharted territories on the federal level. This is the longest federal government shutdown that this country has ever had. And perhaps for some percentage of the population, this week is going to be a big test of how they feel about it when their flights get canceled or significantly delayed. Regina, is this the kind of issue that can sort of speed up negotiations?
Absolutely. It's already starting to. When they said you got to cut 10%, everybody thinks, oh, 10%, that's not sound. It's huge.
It's a lot of flights.
It's a lot of flights. And it's going to be a flight that affects every family. And I think when it starts affecting all the families, especially the families of the congressional and Senate people in Washington, D.C., when they start seeing that, because Reagan is one of the airports that's going to be taking a cut, just like Sky Harbor is.
Jason, is this maybe a potential deal maker for Republicans and Democrats?
Every tick of the clock, we're getting closer and closer to Thanksgiving. There's a lot of holiday travel that's coming up. There's going to be a lot of angry constituents if this isn't fixed by that time.
I mean, I'm the only reason I'm maybe mildly skeptical is there are a lot of folks who are saying come the beginning of the month when SNAP benefits went away, that would be the issue that would bring the sides together. And as we've seen, I mean, Regina, yes, there have been negotiations, but there's still no deal. We're a week into November and still really no clarity on what's going to happen with these SNAP benefits or people who have been getting them that aren't getting them. I guess maybe back to the point you guys were both making at the beginning about bipartisanship, like, is it possible at this point to get the sides together to come to a deal that everybody can live with?
Well, and I just read this morning that is starting to happen. Some from each party are coming together and trying to make their own little budget plan. And I think that's what needs to happen. I don't think you can sit on the sidelines on either side, and that's what's happening right now, is they're sitting on the sidelines waiting for someone to make the first move. Who's going to take the first shot? And you can't do that. We'll sit here, you know, into the first of the year without with the closure.
Yeah.
So I don't think that it's out of the question that over the next week we'll probably see a little bit more movement.
Okay. Over the next week, Jason, is that a reasonable timeline, do you think?
It is for agreement amongst the members of Congress. The problem here is that the Republican Congress needs to have the Trump seal of approval on anything that's done, and that could complicate this. So while I actually have faith that the members of Congress could probably come together and find an agreement, I don't know if the Trump administration is going to sign off on it.
I mean, I guess you also have, while the Senate is working in a bipartisan way, the House has been on recess for I don't even know how long at this point. And Speaker Johnson has not suggested that he's super interested in doing anything other than having the Senate pass the continuing resolution the House passed. Does that potentially change if the Senate passes something that maybe does have the presidential seal of approval and could end the shutdown? Does the House come back and maybe deal with that, even though the leadership doesn't really want to?
Even though the leadership doesn't want to, you still have Trump that wants it. If he ends up going with the Senate proposal, I think the House will come back.
Do either of you think some of the issues with social safety net programs and the stuff we're seeing with airlines and everything, do people's memories last long enough for that to matter come 2026 when they're voting?
I think it does. I think
it does, and I don't think it gives enough time to start correcting it afterward, right? We're already in a time where people are like, I thought that voting for the MAGA agenda was going to fix the economy, and I'm still hurting, and I don't feel better about myself and the world. What's going on? And I don't think that that's going to change now between now and the midterm elections.
And somewhat agreement with him. I think that people still think about what the economy was like prior to this. And it might not be fixed, but it's on its way to being fixed. And I think there's a lot of things that go into factors when you're voting. And the difficulty we're having right now, they might not remember the specific issues, but they're going to remember how they felt during this time.
Well, it kind of raises the issue, Regina, that, and Jason alluded to it, of maybe the issue isn't so much that more and more people are voting Democratic. It's that there might be fewer people who voted for President Trump and Republicans in 2024 bother to vote if they're not as excited about the way things are going or the way that Congress is behaving or the way the president is behaving.
Well, if the president behaves poorly or the economy is doing poorly, I would think that would bring voters out. I don't think they're going to be complacent during that time. That's usually what brings them out.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Regina Cobb, Jason Barraza, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a comedy show in Tempe this weekend takes on a taboo subject in the dating world, cheating.
But first, Mark, have you ever had a pupusa?
I actually have never had one, but I hear they're delicious and they look delicious.
Yes. Well, there's a lot to say about them. Let's let our next guest explain.
The pupusa is a homemade corn tortilla, and inside it's filled with your choice of meat, cheese, and beans, or pretty much any combination of that. Traditionally, the most like common ones would be pork and cheese, bean and cheese, loroco and cheese, which is a plant that's native to Central America. Over the years, you know, we've added, you know, a whole lineup of, you know, different, you know, chicken ones, steak and cheese, shrimp ones. I created a whole line of vegan ones, you know, with different vegan meats and stuff. So you pretty much, I joke around, it's like, whatever you want me to put in a pupusa, I can probably put it in, you know.
Well, Sam, I don't know about you. I am ready for lunch.
Yes. Can we get a couple of those delivered here to the studio? Well, that was the voice of Yesenia Ramirez. She is the organizer of Downtown Phoenix's annual Pupusa Festival, which is taking place this Sunday. And her family owns a string of Salvadoreño restaurants across the valley. She says pupusas are basically the national food of El Salvador, and celebrating them is a chance to celebrate her culture. She spoke more about it with our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
Once you have the pupusa made, you're going to eat it with what's called a curtido. Curtido means pickled. It's shredded cabbage and carrots pickled in vinegar with different seasonings. It also comes with a salsa. So Salvadorans, we're not really known for like the spiciness of our food. So the salsa is more on the mild side, but the blend between the salsa and the curtido with the pupusa, the whole complete bite is the whole flavor profile you're trying to go for.
It sounds like a great combination. It reminds me of like an empanada or something like that. Like this, even a quesadilla, like it's like a version of this exists in a lot of different cultures, but yours is unique to El Salvador.
Yes. You know, you can go to Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and the three countries eat pupusas. Even Belize, I think, eats pupusas too. So they kind of all claim that it's from their country. But the reality is, because of all that back and forth arguing, I think it was like in 2007, I want to say, the government of El Salvador actually declared the second Sunday in November as the National Pupusa Day. And so it made it official that pupusas are, you know, El Salvadoran food. It's a national food. And so now we conquered the pupusas.
It sounds like this is a food that's really like a labor intensive process, right? But really connected to your culture, your homeland.
Yes, it definitely is. The way I see it, it's obviously, you know, we can talk about, you know, like colonialism and all those things that have happened, you know, over the years, you know, to the indigenous community. I mean, El Salvador, or the original people in El Salvador, were indigenous people. You know, then we had the, you know, the people that colonized us came in, and there's things that got erased, but pupusas have survived, you know, all of that. I mean, it's a special dish if you think about it. It's like, it's the one thing of the ancestors that's made it.
A real long history. And that's kind of what you're doing, right? Like exposing this traditional and very Salvadoran food to a broader population with your Pupusa Festival. So tell us about the creation of that. You've been doing this for some years now.
Right. So I've been doing it on my own for the last almost 10 years now.
Wow.
And I mean, it's gone up and down, you know.
So you weren't sure, it sounds like, you were going to put on the Pupusa Festival this year. Why not?
Most of it for personal reasons, and also just I was kind of like, oh, you know, maybe it's, I don't know if I really have the mental, you know, like capacity to be doing this kind of stuff, you know. Yeah. But then I thought about it, and no, this is the reason why I need to be doing this kind of stuff, because this is what brings people together, and it's we have to keep on, you know, thriving, and even if in an environment where we're being kind of, you know, pushed down to not thrive.
You know? Yeah. So you're referring to the kind of political environment, immigration, raids, ICE activity.
Absolutely.
Is there a lot of fear in the Salvadoran community right now because of immigration raids and ICE activity?
I think in general, yeah. I think that definitely there is a lot of fear in the immigration community. You know, you have houses that are mixed households, you know, so even if you have, you know, you might have like half the people in the house, you know, that are status that is legal, and then the other ones are not. And so, you know, you're not walking around, you know, with complete freedom to be actively participant in your community. You know, I've been hearing different things, you know, from different event coordinators, you know, how attendance has been lower, you know, at certain events. You know, restaurants have been reporting slower, you know, sales, you know, during the week. There's definitely been some sort of impact.
So it's economy, it's immigration, it's fear in the community. I mean, are you concerned that, you know, folks are not going to be as willing to show up to a Pupusa Festival this year?
I mean, I hope not. I've been hearing good vibes, you know, so far, you know, so, but I definitely think, there might be like a small percentage of people, you know, that might not be as readily running out, you know, as previous years. I mean, there's definitely that fear factor that kind of kicks in. But I think anytime you host like a party, I always joke around, anytime I host the festival, I think, you know, it's like when you're hosting a party and you're like, is anybody going to show up to my party? You know, it's like, that's kind of where I'm getting right now. I'm getting like the jitters, you know, but I'm truly hoping they're not going to be fearful of coming down.
Let me ask you lastly, Yesenia, tell us, you know, there will be, I'm sure, a million different kinds of pupusas at this festival this weekend. What's your favorite?
My go-to is loroco y queso. Loroco is a plant that's native to Central America. Mm. It's a flower. So before it blooms, it's chopped up. And it's mixed, you know, you can mix it with cheese. In El Salvador, like, you basically, it's like a staple over there. Like, you'll find it in mixed in with cheeses, you know, in tamales and all sorts of dishes. But for me, that's like my go-to pupusa. If the cooks look at me, I show up and I'm like, You need something like, yeah, let her go in cheese.
All right. Well, that is Yesenia Ramirez. She is the organizer of the Arizona Pupusa Festival happening this Sunday. Also the co-owner of three Salvadoreño restaurants around the valley. Yesenia, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. A festival aimed at inspiring its attendees gets underway tonight in Phoenix. Space 55 is putting on Muse Fest, the Inspiration Games, this weekend and next. It includes performances, workshops, and, if all goes well, sparks of inspiration. Kim Porter is a writer and performer and the person behind Muse Fest. She joins me to talk more about it. And, Kim, where did the idea for this come from?
So I was invited by Space 55 for their 20th season. This is their 20th season coming up, to produce the Nine Muses show, which is a show that we have done many times before that grew out of another show. At the heart of it is a variety show of nine female writer performers inspired by the nine Greek muses. And we've done it in the past. But this year, when I was approached in the spring to produce this, I couldn't stop thinking about the idea of inspiration and about what do we do with our inspiration, because I've been ruminating a lot on how overstimulated most of us are. I don't know what the average number, how many streaming services the average number of people has, but I'll sit down at night and be like, I'm so bored. And I have like eight streaming services, right? So I started just thinking, like, what's missing is the actual meaningful engagement. What do we do with our inspiration? And I'm obsessed with helping other people create stuff. So I started thinking, how can I spin this one show into a whole festival that's built around the idea of getting people off their sofas, back out into those third spaces? How do we create a deadline and community so that we build both motivation and momentum? And how do we get people in a short period of time to create something so that they can remember what it was like to go out in the world and create something?
Well, and that's sort of the inspiration, it sounds like, for the second component of this festival, which is a show that will come up on the second weekend called The Nine Muses, which, am I right, this is nine male performers who basically have a week to take something that inspired them from the nine muses and put on a show about that?
That's exactly right. And mirroring that is what we're calling the 7 Minutes in 7 Days show, which is the show created by the audience. So just like the audience can watch inspiration in action by coming to the first weekend and seeing the nine muses, and then, you know, maybe contemplating all week, what will those men create? They only have 7 days to do it. But if a person is feeling brave, they can also create a show for the last day of the festival. And the way that we're supporting that show creation is on the first Sunday of the festival, we are running a workshop so people can get a head start creating something. And at the last day of the festival, anybody in the audience who wants to can perform what they created. So Muse Fest is like, come and see a show and then make a show and then show a show. But also, maybe there's some people that are shy and they only want to watch a show from the sidelines, and that's totally fine as well. So, yeah.
Well, so I'm so intrigued by this concept that you brought up a couple of times now in terms of what do we do with our inspiration? Because it seems to me that kind of goes beyond the idea of, well, how do we get inspired? Like, where do we look for inspiration? It sounds like what you're saying is that's great and we need that. But then how do you take that next step and actually do something with it? How do you use it in some way?
Yeah, I've spent the last like almost 30 years working in either small groups or one-on-one with people that are in the creative process. And what I have discovered over those almost 30 years is that almost everybody needs to construct some type of infrastructure that supports the places where their creative process falls down. Most people can't make it all the way from inspiration to completed project without some, whether it's a writer's group or a deadline or a contest they're going to enter, or maybe they sign up for classes. Most people need something, right? Because we don't have, most people don't have every single one of the geniuses required. We got a couple of the geniuses, like maybe we're great at wonder or we're great at discernment, but we won't do invention unless we have a deadline or intermittent gratification of showing up and reading our pages. And so I'm saying, like, here we are, we're going to inspire you, and then we're also going to provide this other structure so that you can create something over the course of this 7 days. And because we're treating the whole thing like games in the kind of ancient Greek style, like the Pythian games or something, mm-hmm. we're hopefully making it low stakes enough that people feel comfortable risking in a silly and fun way.
Do you think that people know which step of the process they need help with when it comes to going from being inspired to using it in some way?
I think most people do not know. I think what happens is they try to create a project, they come up against their resistance, and they either learn how to unpack that resistance, or they end up telling themselves a story, which is, I guess I wasn't meant to do it. And my philosophy is, you're meant to do it. You just aren't meant to write like Stephen King writes, or any of the other books that you've read that have told you how to do it. You're going to have to unpack what's stopping you. And then here's about a million different tricks you can try to make yourself actually create something.
Is there something about this current moment that you think makes a festival like this particularly important?
I think we have become completely habituated to virtual and asynchronous communication. Who's to say whether or not we would be as lost as we were if it weren't for the pandemic? I mean, I think people are still trying to come back out. They're still just now coming to terms with, like, what became the new normal. And I think we would have found ourselves in this weird place anyway, even if we hadn't had the pandemic, because there's just only so much constant entertainment and the lack of the third space that we don't have anymore. Our third space is, you know, social media. It's not real. It's asynchronous. And I think we have to come back out into the real world. I mean, if I could wave a magic wand, I would make every teenager have to drive around in a car and go find their group of friends hanging out in a McDonald's parking lot again. If I could get people to remember what it was like to go into the real world, form a tiny gang, and make something happen, I would. But I don't have that power, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That is Kim Porter, a writer and performer, and the person behind MuseFest, the Inspiration Games. Kim, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Comedian Chloe Radcliffe brings her solo show to Tempe Center for the Arts this weekend. The show is called Cheat, and it takes on one of the third rails in American culture, infidelity in relationships. Radcliffe herself has a long history of cheating, and as she told me recently, the show is her attempt to figure out how and why she ended up betraying her own values.
I desperately want to be liked. That's sort of the point of the whole show. It's sort of, you know, a huge amount of what animated a lot of the cheating, which is funny because I'm doing the most deeply unlikable thing. We have more sympathy for murderers and serial killers on TV than we do for cheaters. Like, if you want to signal that a character is bad, you make them cheat. You don't make them kill. You make them cheat.
Right, right. That's a really interesting point, Chloe. I hadn't thought about that because there's basically a cottage industry of fictional TV shows that, and non-fictional TV shows, actually, that try to humanize murderers.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, one of the reasons I was interested to talk to you is I've never seen somebody talk about this the way you're talking about it.
Yeah. And the show does not condone cheating. I think cheating is always bad. I think cheating always hurts somebody. That said, a lot of relationships do involve cheating. And I think that if we wanted stuff like this to stop, we would want people to talk about it.
Right.
And all of the nonfiction series about serial killers, they don't make you say, and it is okay to be a serial killer, but they do illuminate why a person who is the same species as you and me could do something that feels so alien, that feels so inhuman.
One of the things that you're doing that I find really fascinating, especially early on, is kind of inviting the audience to consider, like, well, what do we mean when we say cheating?
Totally. I basically ask, you know, what counts as cheating? Mm-hmm. And that came out of a conversation with a friend where I said something about, you know, I basically made reference to what really counts as cheating. And he sort of shrugged and looked at me and was sort of in the, like, what do you mean what counts as cheating? We all know what counts as cheating. And I say, great, let's take kissing as the line. I think that's the line that most people would point to. And then I walk through some scenarios that don't involve kissing, mm-hmm. that are, I think, incredibly hurtful.
Right.
And I think that way more people have bumped up against this fuzzy, fuzzy line than would ever self-identify as having bumped up against the line.
You use this formulation in the show of inside Chloe and outside Chloe. And it's this really wonderful device because it allows you to talk about your lived experience of these behaviors versus what people might assume about somebody who would do those things. Tell me about coming up with that device of inside Chloe versus outside Chloe. Was that a way you thought of yourself as a person moving through the world before you wrote this, or did you come up with it for the show?
It came up because of the show, but it was so organic. It was so unintentional. It just blossomed out of me trying to rectify. I look very different than I, and not even very, very different, but like different enough that the world treats me differently mm-hmm. than how I looked a few years ago. And trying to express how I behave based on how I am assuming the world sees me. From when I weighed a little bit more, when I was less put together, when I dressed a little stupider, when I didn't know how to do my hair, versus now when I weigh a little bit less, when I know how to do my hair, when I dress a little bit cooler, when I'm a little bit more New York. In the past, I was a little bit more Midwest, which is where I grew up. And I feel the world interact with me differently. And now I feel these expectations that from the outside that don't align with how I see myself, because how I see myself is rooted in the decades of, you know, childhood and formative years. You know, there's such a fine line between a reason and an excuse. And I do not want to make an excuse, but I want to lay out the reasons.
I find that fascinating because the show has so many moments of real self-confrontation. And if I may, one of them for me is the way that you talk about the men in your life. Because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you talk about being treated a certain way based on the way you looked when you were younger and as recently as just a few years ago. In the show, you say that, you know, people called you a freak. And then in the show, as an adult, you're talking about being attracted to men who you don't necessarily find physically attractive. And you use these phrases to talk about them, like smelly troll, small face, cricket, neckbeard.
My poor exes. I hope they never hear this.
Well, tell me about that choice, because I had the sense that it was intentional.
Man, Sam, nobody has ever quite just pulled out the, like, so you say three really mean things about real people. What do you think about that? And when you frame it like that, it sounds bad. It's pretty hard to defend. Yeah, I am always trying to disarm and be as honest as possible and not romanticized. My goal is to make a thing that makes people feel seen in a way that they had written off hope of ever feeling seen like that ever. And I think so many people have the experience of, like, you know, my love story is not, or my romance story is not, doesn't fit a rom-com vehicle. It doesn't fit, you know, what somebody is supposed to look like. It doesn't fit how I'm supposed to feel. It doesn't fit who I'm supposed to be attracted to. And I find it most interesting to talk about, you know, what happens when you don't feel good enough about yourself to expect anything more than the bottom rung. And so you wind up with somebody who you don't actually see yourself with, but that's who's there. You know, I think that a lot of people have that experience. And again, it's like, I don't really hear people talking about that. And I want to be the one to talk about it.
How has this project affected you? Like, has it taken a toll? Has it increased your self-perception?
It has uncovered parts of me to me that I was so cocky about coming into the development process. I was so cocky that I knew myself completely. There's stuff that I totally was turning a blind eye to. It's like I was doing the thing that people in the audience are doing that I want to model. It's possible to look at the worst parts of yourself and not like I'm cheating more. I'm not cheating. Now I'm in this incredibly happy, incredibly monogamous relationship with a man who saw the show before we ever started dating, and he's wonderful. And we once a month he goes, "Are you cheating on me?" And I go, "No." And I love it. Like I love, you know, it's like I'm so happy in my relationship. Now the show certainly has made me a different partner. I am so more able to be on top of myself.
Well, Chloe Radcliffe is a comedian, and her show Cheat will be at the Tempe Center for the Arts this Saturday, November 8th. Chloe, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Sam, I don't know about you. Still thinking about those pupusas.
Oh, yeah. I'm putting in the order right now.
Yeah. Can you get one for me as well?
Yeah.
I'll pay you back, of course. But...
Sure. No, I think I'm going to order 12 just to be safe.
That seems reasonable. That's a good weekend right there. All right. That'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Have a terrific weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.